The following podcast contains adult subject matter. Listener discretion is advised. All right, here we are, guys, on the floor of San Diego Comic-Con in the IDW booth, and we are talking with Gabriel Rodriguez, who is genuinely one of the, I feel like one of the most interesting comic book artists there is. Obviously, he's known for his work on Lock and Key and also some work on Nosferatu, which is quickly becoming a television show. Gabe, yeah, how are you doing today, man?
Yeah, how are you doing, Gabriel? Nice to be talking to you, and thank you. It's a pleasure to be here always.
So, my first question is going to jump into, like, a really weird spot.
Okay.
I have read that you were an architect for a time.
Yeah.
One of my favorite French comic book artists is a guy named Francois Chutin.
Yeah.
Okay. And he did Obscure Cities, which is, like, just this beautifully architectural book. And
yeah.
Lock and Key has a lot of that architectural aspect to it because it takes place in a house.
Yeah.
How do you feel architecture helped you develop, like, the look of Lock and Key?
Well, in the case of Lock and Key, it was a key part of helping me achieve the appeal that I thought the story needed. And basically because of two things. One, it is that I knew from the get-go that Key House was going to be as an important character as any member of the family. So I knew that I was going to be needing to draw the house over and over from different points of view. And most of the main action of the story was going to happen inside. So I took the challenge of making it as an actual architectural project. So I did the blueprints of the house, I laid out it entirely, and gave that as a reference for Joe to write certain action scenes inside the house, because that helped us both to make it more vivid and real. And I always thought that when you figure out a proper way to represent space and environment in a comic, not necessarily needing to be realistic, but has to be, like, consistent and understandable. And through architectures, I learned, like, lots of tools that allowed me to make, like, a vivid and consistent environment for the stories. And I think that helps a lot, especially in a story that deals a lot with magic and fantastic elements, to be able to create a believable environment in which all that weirdness happens makes the story more appealing for the reader.
So when you're working within that believable environment that you've created, and then you have to switch your brain over to the fantastical, what are some of the challenges in there?
Well, the thing is, when the story's appealing and you get what the characters had to be about, that shift, it somewhat becomes easier because you understand what's the role that that shift is playing in the storytelling. So I think if you have a clear idea of what you want to tell in the story and how you want to tell it, that shift becomes something natural. And it's basically you understand that it's having a dramatic purpose to fit in the story, to tell it in the way it is. So, and also, when you have the chance to create an environment like the town of Lovecraft or Key House itself, that you have to make, like, very real and believable for the reader, and then you can pop out in between that with very weird and unexpected elements, it became a sort of a more interesting dramatic hook to enhance certain aspects of the story. So for us, it was all about that. It was creating a frame in which the paranormal, fantastic elements pop out and reveal something about the drama that's happening for the characters. And that's basically how we approach it, both Joe and myself, when we were working on Walking Dead.
So the tradition of magical realism is really strong in South American literature.
Yeah.
Do you think that having that, like, kind of as part of a culture that you were immersed in, do you think that helped you in the creation of Lock and Key?
It wasn't that an aware process to relate those things, but I think certainly my background to be raised in that culture and environment helped me. I think it felt very natural for me. I never felt I was being forced to create something that I wouldn't understand. So even in Chile, we have lots of, like, province towns in which there's a lot of tradition of fantastic stories and ghost stories and spooky stories. So all of that was captured in a different way in Lock and Key, but it's sort of a narrative tradition of the same sort. So for me, it felt incredibly comfortable, and I think that like one of the most naturally fluid creative process that I've ever had was the one of creating Lock and Key, and I think it's certainly cemented in that.
You know, obviously each of the keys within the key house does something totally different.
Yeah.
Was there one that you found like more challenging than the other ones to like create an idea behind?
I think that the concepts were really clear for us, for Joe and myself, because we knew what we wanted to trigger in the drama of the story with the keys, but certainly there were some of them that presented challenges in terms of not making like look overly weird or goofy that would take you out of the story. I think in that regard, to be able to show properly, for example, how the head key work was like, I think like the most challenging part of it, because that's the weirdest of all the keys that take place in the story. And we knew that we had a risk that by using that, it would make like, it would eventually be the risk of taking the reader out of the story if it was too weird or too goofy to present. But then Joe has an amazing skill to be able to put humor bits inside the story without like taking the drama part of it. And that was great. And then we also had this idea from the get-go that when people uses the head key, you mostly doesn't see how the magic operates on the body of the guy that's using the head key, but then you see the reaction of the people that's seeing it. So we never show how, for example, the heads open up when you use the head key. Just see the guy with the head already open and what's inside. But in a couple of times, we showed how people reacted to the opening of the head, and that was much more interesting and fun to portray than actually showing how it opens up. So leaving those little elements that were never openly showed into the story itself, I think also helped us to create a more dense atmosphere of mystery about how these magic keys actually really work.
You know, it's interesting, like, knowing that Joe Hill is the son of Stephen King, and like,
yeah,
Stephen King's this master of horror, and
yeah,
he's probably been surrounded by that his whole life. You know, it's interesting to know that you guys understand the concept of sometimes it's better to like not show the things,
exactly,
so that your imagination,
exactly,
creates what's happening.
Because usually the reader's expectation of something dreadful or mysterious or weird, that expectation is always better than anything that you can give them to fulfill that expectation. So being able to hold on into certain elements and let the reader imagination to complete the density of the mystery or the horror helps you a lot to tell a better story. I think in a way that also creates a sort of bond of complicity between the readers and the authors, I think, and makes them more engaged and invested in the story. And I think that's one of the secrets of why Lock and Key is so engaging to the readers and has helped us to have a readership that's incredibly passionate about the story and the characters and incredibly loyal, and have been waiting all these years for us to return to this universe to tell new stories. So we're very excited to be in that spot right now and being able to offer them new visits to the Lock and Key universe now.
So please tell me a little bit about the new like things that are coming out surrounding Lock and Key.
Well, the thing is that as soon as we finish doing the original arc of Lock and Key and complete the story of Tyler and their siblings, we immediately realized that we would need like new fresh ideas to return to this world in order not to feel that we were exploiting the success that we had. And also we had other projects that we wanted to do. But I think right now is the right time because that pause has given us enough time to discuss the ideas that we wanted to do. And the first thing that we're going to do is to complete the round of short stories that we have been doing throughout years, which are going to collect a seventh book of Lock and Key that's going to be called The Golden Age, in which we're visiting the story of the family of Chamberlain Locks and his children, which are like the great-grandfathers of the Lock Kids of the Lock and Key story. And that helps us also to increase the mythology around Key House and the story of the Locks. And that seventh volume is going to become a sort of a volume zero of a new series of miniseries that we want to do right after that. That will be called World War Key, and which is basically will visit the past of the Locke family in certain historical spots like the Revolutionary War and World War One and World War Two. And in between that, we will be telling new stories of the Locke family that we already know and love. And they will be, in a way, like facing challenges that will be related to these past stories. So it will be both a revisitation of the Locke family that we knew in the first arc, and then also to visit other times in the past of Locke's legacy and how their family history keeps having an effect in the future generation of the Locks.
Oh, so sounds amazing.
Yeah, we think it's going to be really exciting, both for us as creators, as for readers to engage in that.
Thank you, Gabe, so much for your time. I really appreciate it, and I'm looking very much so forward to the new editions of Locke and Key.
Yeah.
Hopefully we can talk to you soon about it again.
Yeah, sure. That's the idea. So thanks for being here, and it was a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of the Thinking Outside the Long Walks podcast. Join us on Facebook and Twitter to get behind-the-scenes information for exclusive content and to be notified when new episodes are available. The thoughts and opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the individual and do not necessarily represent or reflect those of the Thinking Outside the Long Walks podcast, Barren Space Productions, its partners, or affiliates. The Thinking Outside the Long Box podcast is made available by its creators, Juan, John, and Gabe. The podcast is edited and produced by Juan, and Albie is the co-executive producer. The Thinking Outside the Long Box podcast is a Barren Space production.